liberty, equality, and fraternity. These are the are three of the most important of the what's known as the Enlightenment values. And my knowledge of European history is a bit shaky, but the period known as the Enlightenment was the period where these values of freedom, equality and fraternity, and the power of reason, wrested control of, wrested the imagination of people away from the old patriarchies, the old hierarchical structures and kingdoms and so on, and laid the foundation for the modern world with its notions of democracy, human rights, and so on. And I wanted to talk a little bit about these values because as the Enlightenment that we call as a historical phenomenon was essentially a European thing, then it's often felt that these values are alien to Eastern values or alien to specifically Buddhist values. I don't believe that's the case at all. I believe that actually the Enlightenment values are universal human values, and that they are enunciated and part of the Buddha's own value system long before they became instrumental in the European Enlightenment. Of course, at the moment we're witnessing another step in the evolution or the application of these values. The people in Libya, as we speak, are on the streets demanding change, as the people of Egypt were, or I believe still are, and many, many other Arab countries, Tunisia, Yemen, Bahrain, Iran, Morocco, and elsewhere. And people have woken up, what they call people power. They've gone onto the streets and they're demanding things which essentially is not dissimilar from these Enlightenment values. It's part of the same spectrum of things. They want political freedom, freedom from oppression. They want equality, in the sense they want their voice to be able to be listened to and not to be in a dictatorial hierarchy where everything comes from the top down. So one of the aspects of the Enlightenment philosophy is that political power extends from the people and not the other way around, rather than the idea that the mandate of the ruler was given from above, from heaven, which is the more conventional idea. And of course we see the value of fraternity there as well, because all the people bonding together, groups of people, crowds of people, not people acting as individuals, but people acting with one voice. So the idea of fraternity is based on a relationship between equals, or at least more or less equals, yeah, brothers and sisters. Okay, brothers and sisters might not be entirely equal, but it's a relatively equal relationship compared with the relationship between, say, parents and children. That's what we call a paternal relationship. And so there's this kind of need or desire for people to move to a fraternal relationship rather than a paternal one. Now, when these things are discussed in a Buddhist context, many people from traditional Buddhist countries are very used to having Buddhism structured in a very patriarchal way, in a way that where there isn't an idea of equality, where there is a strong hierarchy, where power comes from above, where it's regarded as the prerogative of a small elite group to make decisions for the benefit of the majority, and so on. And so these enlightenment values haven't really taken hold in the traditional, certainly in the Sangha structures. So we have this kind of uneasy dichotomy in countries like Thailand, where the secular society is governed by enlightenment values, it's democratic, there's equality, there's human rights and so on. But the Sangha structures are not. There's no democracy, there's no equality, there's no voice. There are different ways of looking at these different situations. One way of looking at it is you say, well, it's certain ways of doing these things are appropriate in certain cultural contexts. There's no doubt some truth to that. But I personally don't believe that. I believe that's a very shallow explanation. It's not merely the case that it happens to be more or less suitable in different situations, but I believe that there's a genuine evolution involved, an actual progression, and that progression mirrors and echoes the normal progression of and development of a human individual. And as we all know, when we're young, we're very much under paternal control. What our parents say goes, they have the authority, and so on. And by and large, that's a good thing. And children don't know what they should be doing. They don't know what's right and what's wrong. And by and large, the authority, the parents are benevolent. They do love their children. And when things work well, they use that authority when it's appropriate, and then when it's appropriate, they learn to let go and allow their child to make their own decisions. So there's this evolution. Later in life, we don't expect our parents to be making these decisions for us in the same way. And in the last part of our life, then for the most part, our parents are gone. And so our lives and society, the context we find ourselves in, becomes much more fraternal as we mature. That becomes a relationship of equals, and that we learn to participate and communicate with others on a basis of equality and fraternity. And I think it's important to be aware of this and to be conscious of this, that there is an actual genuine evolution there. As usual, of course, the Buddha was so far ahead of everybody else that the values and the structures as embodied in the Vinaya, in fact, represent the enlightenment values to an even far deeper degree than has ever been found in any European civilization. The value of equality, the ability of people within the Sangha to have their say in Sangha comers and so on, is even more so than in any Western society. The level of inequality between people in terms of the hierarchy of power or anything is much less than in any secular society. The degree of freedom that people have is also far greater within the Sangha than within any secular society. Essentially, in a secular society, if you don't behave yourself, if you don't do what the state wants, then the state will punish you, it will imprison you, and so on. And it will, in a fairly short order, resort to physical violence and imprisonment in order to make its citizens behave. Whereas in the Sangha, we don't have anything remotely like that. And our means of controlling people, if they don't come from a place of goodwill and they don't want to do the right thing, our means of controlling them are very limited and very, very, very gentle. much more gentle than used even by the most enlightened of secular societies. And similarly with the quality of fraternity, the quality that the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis should look on each other with eyes of loving kindness, and that they should always be thinking of what, not what is good for me, but what is good for the other person. And then the beautiful reflection where we think, oh, should I do what I want to do, or should I do what that other venerable wants to do? And then I put aside what I want to do and I do what that other venerable wants me to do. So that we would share everything that we have, even down to the food we get in our alms bowl. So this enlightenment value of fraternity is actually far, far deeper and far greater within the Sangha, within the structure of the Vinaya, than it has been in any enlightened secular society, enlightenment-based secular society coming from the West or anywhere else. So I think it's important for us to recognize these things, to recognize that the Buddha did actually care. He did actually want to create a culture, a way that people could live together that was characterized by respect, by kindness, and that he was quite prepared to put in practical guidelines and to devote time and effort and so on to make these things happen. So the Buddha didn't just tell everybody, let go and give yourself up to the form. When people came to him with complaints, he didn't just say, this is your pride or this is your conceit or this is your attachment to your views and opinions. He listened to them carefully, and when it was necessary, then he would respond. And he put in mechanisms that required that the Sangha would act in a similar way. So that kind of culture, living in that kind of society, requires, of course, a great deal of maturity. And if people are dysfunctional within that, it's not easy to make it work. I remember when I was involved in the environmental and animal rights movement in the 80s, I had a friend who was an anarchist. He used to run an anarchist-based print shop in Fremantle in WA, and he said that they had a problem with one guy who just came and started living in their office. It was really hard for them to get any work done because this guy was just camped out in the middle of the office with all his stuff, and he just refused to leave. He said, well, you're anarchists, you don't believe in private property, so I'm just going to stay here. This is as much of my place as it is yours. What do you do? Something like that. And this is why, because people don't do the right thing, because they don't embody those values of treating others with respect, of listening to them with kindness, of putting aside one's own wishes and doing what others wish. And then because we don't live up to those values, then we end up finding it very difficult to maintain this kind of society, kind of culture, whether it be in a monastery or in a wider society or wherever it may be. So when I see these things happening in the world, and I read the newspaper in the morning, and I see that the people are uprising, I feel so much empathy with them. And when I heard that the Egyptian dictatorship of Mubarak had fallen, and that there'd been a revolution with almost no violence at all and no killing, I cried, because I just felt so happy that finally people would be listened to. And I really believe in these values. I'm not, at my heart, I'm very idealistic. I'm not, even though I can be quite cynical and quite critical sometimes, but at my heart I'm very, very idealistic. And I really deeply believe that if we live properly by these values, promotes and encourages the growth of people, the growth of human beings. It improves happiness, it improves welfare. It makes a better world. Not a perfect world, of course. Yeah, but still, a world that's a bit better. And you don't make all the problems go away by adopting a different value system. But you can make it a bit easier to work with the genuine difficulties that we're faced with. And one of the fallacies, I think, that we sometimes hear in Buddhism is that these kinds of things are dismissed as being merely worldly or secular concerns, and that the Buddha was only concerned with Nibbana. Anyone who's familiar with the Buddhist text would know this obviously is untrue. But what's more interesting to me is not merely the fact that it's untrue. What's interesting is, first of all, why people want it to be true. Why there is this misunderstanding. Why do people want their Dhamma to be like this? And I'm not 100% sure, but I think part of it has to do with fear. Perhaps part of it is the difference between growing up in a society where politics has been frequently repressive and dangerous, and that makes you very afraid to bring Buddhism into the political and social sphere. Whereas, say, growing up in Australia, where politics is generally speaking not threatening in the same way, that we're a bit more comfortable with that, perhaps, that's one reason. But in any case, whatever the reasons there might be why that idea is there, what that idea also, I think, betrays is the fact that it betrays the organic unity of the Dhamma. The fact that the Buddha himself preferred egalitarian, equal, fraternal, principle-based, open, transparent, and so on, organizational principles when he was setting up the Sangha. We see these things all through the Vinaya. And that's not just an accident. It doesn't just happen to be the case that he didn't set up the Dhamma and the Vinaya as a paternalistic, top-down power structure with secrecy and titles and hierarchies and all of the things that you see in Sangha organizations today. It's not just an accident of history. And as we know from the history of the time, that the Buddha actually was surrounded by and moved in different kinds of societies with different kinds of structures. There were benevolent kings who ruled wisely and well, like Bimbisara. There were other benevolent kings who ruled perhaps with the best intentions, but perhaps not so wisely, as like King Pasenadi. There were unbenevolent kings, like King Chandrapajota of Ujjaini, who was quite a dictator and violent and so on. There were the republics, like the Vajjayan Republic, who ruled by an aristocratic collective, quite basically ruled by the landowning clans, or then the upper class clans, and so on. So the Buddha had a variety of influences. So we can't say that his manner in which he constructed the Sangha was simply determined by the cultural forces that surrounded him. He constructed it because he wanted to. He chose it a bit to be that way. And he took the relatively democratic, equal and open structure that was used by Vajjayans and other republicans and took it even further. Made it even more democratic, more open, more equal, more free, more fraternal. So he actually introduced all of those enlightenment values into the Sangha. It's interesting to note that at the same time as the Buddha was doing this, creating his Sangha, in the West we had, of course, Socrates and Plato, who were writing this. Plato wrote this long treatise called The Republic, where he, in a sense, set up his idea of an ideal society. Of course, Plato was talking about society as a whole, not just a community, although there were Greek philosophers like Pythagoras and Epicurus, who did set up their own communities. But the Republic was set up supposedly to govern the society as a whole, and it was a very top-down authoritarian system, basically built on the idea of a benevolent philosopher king who would rule wisely, because people didn't really know how to make decisions for themselves. So even while Greece was moving to a more democratic model, Socrates and Plato were arguing against that. So the Buddha didn't. Obviously, the Buddha was primarily concerned with the spiritual path, with the practice of meditation, with understanding the nature of reality, and so on and so forth. That's obvious, it's taken for granted. He was primarily a religious teacher, and his social organization and so on was a secondary matter. We all know that. We don't have to hammer that home. The Buddha wasn't primarily a social reformer or anything like that. But that's different from saying that he didn't care about the wider society. He cared. And when it was possible, and when living within the bounds of what was suitable for a samana and so on, then he would offer help and advice to various people on those social and secular matters. And again, we find this kind of thing happening constantly through the suttas. So I mentioned before this idea of the organic unity of the Dhamma, and that these ideas like equality, liberty, fraternity are actually part of the very structure of the Dhamma. Now, the meaning of these words, taken to a profound Dhamma level, of course, is different from the meaning of those words as expressed in a mere social reform, such as happened in Europe, or as is happening today through the Arab world. And for freedom, as far as the secular world goes, has a very limited meaning. It means, well, you're free to speak without being thrown in jail. It means you're free to marry who you wish to, or to work where you want, or get your education, or to travel. And generally speaking, it means you're free to do what you want as long as it doesn't harm others. And this is how freedom applies in the secular world. And of course that's very limited, because once you're free to do all those things, people sometimes choose to do good things, choose to do bad things, choose to do things that are useful and choose to do things that are harmful. And so there's not necessarily any wisdom there. But that doesn't mean the freedom is wrong, it just means that the freedom is incomplete, and it should be accompanied also by wisdom. Perhaps that was an enlightenment value that needed to be emphasized more. That once we have the freedom to make our choice, we're also responsible to make wise choices. So the freedom in Buddhism, vimokkha, the liberation of arahant, liberation of nibbana, is a different kind of thing. But it's not completely separate. It's not totally divorced from the that other kind of freedom, because an arahant also is in a place where their behavior, what they say and what they do, is not constrained and forced from outside, but it comes from inside. It comes from their own sense of what's right and what's wrong, their own sense of what's true and what's not, their own sense of wisdom. And so there's this sense of responsibility and maturity that's inherent in the Buddhist notion of enlightenment. And so really that freedom which an arahant experiences, yes, it's at a far deeper level, but it's not a different kind of thing than the freedom, the secular freedom that we want in our societies. And similarly with equality. So again, the equality in society, we don't, you know, we actually set a pretty low bar as far as equality goes, I think. You know, we're, you know, obviously people have different intelligence, different skills, different effort and all of these kinds of things, and people end up different. Some people have different kinds of jobs, they earn more or less money, they have bigger or smaller houses. They're generally speaking, why not? Yeah, if somebody wants to have a bigger house and they're prepared to work for it, then oh, good on them. And somebody else who'd rather have more time for leisure time or artistic activities or something, have less income and have a smaller place to stay, then why shouldn't they? Yeah? As long as it doesn't harm others, then there's no reason why society shouldn't have these kinds of natural or ordinary kinds of inequality. So what we talk about when we talk about equality is that people shouldn't be discriminated against because they are women or because they're black or because they're poor or because of any of the other, because they belong to the wrong caste if you're in India, or because they're disabled or because they're gay or whatever. And so equality means essentially that people are treated as if they have equal dignity. There's like an ethical equality, it doesn't mean an equality in fact. And so the same thing also applies in Buddhism. Of course, from a Buddhist notion, a Buddhist ethics, for example, the precept to not kill, yeah, of course, is quite, you know, there's an equality there. Not killing anybody is wrong. You don't sort of make hierarchies of better and worse people to kill. We have equality in terms of that each person is essentially similar. We have it's essentially made of the five aggregates. We all have greed, hatred, and delusion. Or if we've practiced the Eightfold Path, we don't have greed, hatred, and delusion. And so the basic nature of people is similar. And in fact, that extends even further than the Enlightenment philosophy, because it implies to animals and to beings in other realms as well. And the notion of fraternity, the notion is the emotional aspect, yeah, and this, the idea that one has a loving relationship with others, and a loving relationship with others as equals, as peers. And so, again, within Buddhism, you have this idea of metta and karuna, the Brahma Viharas, which are extended to everyone, yeah, sabbatataya, to each as to oneself. And so, this idea of a fraternity that goes even far further than the fraternity of the European Enlightenment. But it's essentially a similar principle, but taken to a far more profound degree. So these notions, which are sometimes stigmatized and criticized as being Western notions or alien to Buddhist culture and so on, are not alien at all. In the way that they're expressed, in the details in which they're applied, yes, of course, they're bound and conditioned to a particular historical context, and it's not always appropriate, obviously, to apply that historical context to other places. So the way equality, liberty, fraternity are expressed in Buddhist cultures is not going to be the same in every respect as the way these things are expressed in non-Buddhist cultures. So obviously that's true, but the basic principle, the basic value is there, and it's not peripheral, it's not just being politically correct, it's not just sort of adapting and watering down Dhamma to suit Western tastes. It's actually something which is found there fundamentally in the very structure of the Dhamma itself. Like so much of what we find in Buddhism, the truly beautiful and inspiring teachings of the Buddha, which go so far beyond anything which is found elsewhere. But these things get caught up and bound up in worldly aspirations and concerns, and gradually, little bit by little bit, we lose sight of where the true Dhamma lies. And so when we're thinking about and when we're trying to work with the relationship between these externals, the Dhamma of freedom, the liberty of a people, and then the Dhamma in terms of the freedom of the mind in Buddhism, then it's not helpful to set these things up in opposition to each other, to treat them as if it's some kind of dichotomy that these things are somehow arranged against each other. In fact, there are good reasons why the word enlightenment, which was actually used primarily of this phase in European history, which gave birth to the French Revolution and the American Revolution and so on, and the birth of democracy. There's very good reasons why the European scholars, Rhys Davids and Oldenburg and so on, when they were talking about the Buddha's enlightenment experience, they used this same word. They actually adopted that word from the political social sphere and used it in the spiritual sphere, even though for us it's now much more well known in the spiritual sphere rather than the other way around. And they did that because they wanted to point out to their audience of cultured European scholars and intellectuals, they wanted to point out that this historical phenomenon, which they were already familiar with, the historical phenomenon of the Enlightenment, in fact had important things in common with this spiritual experience from ancient India, which we know today as the Buddha's Enlightenment. And they were quite correct. There are important things in common. There are important parallels. So when we are trying to bring Dhamma into our activities, bring Dhamma into our acts of body, speech and mind, we should bear this in mind, and we should bear in mind that kind of analogy, that those parallels, they're not just an abstract intellectual thing, they're something that actually creates the very lifestyle by which we live every day. The fact that those ultimate values of the Dhamma, the ultimate values of Nibbana, freedom from greed, hatred and delusion and all of these things, these have informed and educated and created the values that underlie the Vinaya, that underlie the monastic culture within which we live. And they're constantly informing and nourishing our choices and our lives every day. So it's important that we pay attention to this and that we notice and question how our acts, or whether our acts, are embodying and reflecting these principles of Dhamma or not. How it can be improved. If we find that we are acting in a way that transgresses these values, then we'll probably find that underlying that there's something transgressing some Dhamma principle, that greed, hatred and delusion has arisen somehow and is compromising and undermining our ability to embody and really live the Dhamma in every day. So that's just a few thoughts and reflections for you this evening on liberty, equality, fraternity, on the very historic occasion of the what may well be seen in the future as the bringing of the Enlightenment, so in terms of the European Enlightenment, to the Arab world. And I wanted to reflect on these values and to bring them within a Buddhist context. So this is my little talk for you this evening, and I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.